Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Well, hello and welcome to the Smart Family Podcast. I'm so glad you could join us today as we talk about the topic of autism with Dr. Barry Prezant. I was so pleased when he agreed to be on our podcast because he is the author of the book called Uniquely Human, which is really a unique and positive view of autism. And so I'm so excited to speak to him today.
Rob, I'm excited about this conversation too. And I have to say that, you know, I don't often comment about our guest's books, but his book really gripped me in that he had so many stories of working with patients with autism and, you know, how he was able to draw them out in terms of their communication. Mm-hmm. Like, I just found that what he had to say was fascinating.
Absolutely, I agree. And, you know, kids with autism are some of my favorite patients, actually. But, you know, they're some of the most difficult to diagnose or the easiest to diagnose. Because sometimes, you know, you can diagnose them when they're out in the hallway just by the way they talk and what they're saying and just what their speech is like. But other times, they've been in my practice for years before we settle on a diagnosis of autism. So it's really interesting from just a diagnostic perspective. But I love interacting with them and having great conversations with them.
Rob, I'm hoping that for you who are listening, this conversation today will just help give you more insight into what's going on in the in the brain of somebody who has autism.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree.
So Barry Prezant is a world-renowned practitioner in the area of autism. He has over 40 years as a scholar, researcher, program director. He's an adjunct professor with Brown University, and he's written a highly influential best-selling book called Uniquely Human. So without any further delay, let's get into our conversation with Dr. Barry Prezant.
Well, Dr. Barry Prezant, it's such a privilege and an honor to have you on our podcast today.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
You have really spoken and written so much about autism spectrum. You have a podcast out now as well, a great book as well called Uniquely Human. Thank you for bringing this topic to really the masses and for educating all of us and giving us your insights. I'd love to talk to you today about autism and some of the details of it and nuances and really, you know, speak to parents and families about autism. Now, it's defined as a disorder of social communication and restricted and repetitive behaviors. I mean, if you look in the DSM-5, that's what you'll read. Mm-hmm. But you take a bit more of a positive view of autism than simply a checklist of behaviors and problems to solve. How do you define autism? And if someone were to ask you, what is autism, how would you respond to that question?
Sure. I like to say that I take a more balanced view, I would say, that I think, you know, what I referred to in 1983 as a deficit checklist approach doesn't really get at the potential strengths that we see in some individuals. It doesn't really get at the complexity of a person on the spectrum. So I'm going to go the opposite direction from complexity. I once asked a third grade class in which there was a couple of students with autism, what is autism? And the comment that really resonated with me, one little boy said, autism is when you're really good at some things, but not so good at other things. And I think there's a lot of insight there because in more technical terms, what he's saying is that to understand autism, you first have to understand children or adults who have a very uneven developmental profile. They are very good at some things and not so good and sometimes severely challenged at other things. Now, what are those things? Certainly, as DSM says, social communication, relating to other people. I think there are a lot of myths that, you know, for example, some people say kids on the spectrum, especially when they're very young, are non-communicative. There's a phrase, a writer named John Woods many years ago said, one cannot not communicate.
Right.
That it's up to us to be able to read a child, even though they don't speak. You know, how do they use gestures? How do they vocalize? But certainly the ability to acquire communication that is easily understandable or readable to other people is a challenge for many people. Even for those who are very fluent in their use of language, sometimes the way they use language may not be easily understood. So I like to think of people on the spectrum as having an uneven developmental profile, particularly challenged in social communication. But another area that's not emphasized enough, and parents know this, you know this, is what we refer to as emotional regulation. Being able to maintain a state, both a physiological state and an emotional state, that allows them to be most available to learn and most available to interact and engage with other people. So as a matter of fact, emotional regulation has become one of the hottest areas of research in autism over the last 5 to 10 years. And we began talking about that in the 1990s. And that's a big part of our educational model. And when you talk about sensory issues, so common, sensory sensitivities, that would fall under our emotional regulation category. So what that results in, to kind of summarize, is that people on the spectrum, for the areas that they're challenged in, that they're not so good at, they need a lot of extra support. So in our educational model, we have a whole category of all the different ways we support them. Interpersonally, such as simplifying language, educationally, such as using a lot of visual supports. So that's our focus and the way we understand autism.
I think people commonly find autism to be confusing. You talked about it being a spectrum, and some people with autism are nonverbal or they're challenged to communicate, whereas others are high functioning and manage to go on and complete post-secondary degrees. And so can you comment on that spectrum? Can people shift along the spectrum?
Mm-hmm. And I think a reasonable question is, how can you have such varied abilities and still have it come under the same label? Let me just give you a little bit of a background of my background. I'm a developmentalist. Mm-hmm. My training is in child and human development. So what I look at is, how does a child develop language? How does a child develop motor skills? How does a child develop emotionally? So the reason you can have under this wide spectrum kind of the same name is, it's the developmental profile is similar, whether you have a college professor who's on the spectrum, who still has problems in more sophisticated social communication and in emotional regulation, or you could have a 2.5 or 3-year-old for where they are in development, that profile of strengths and challenges is mirrored in that person. So about your question about, can you move along the spectrum? The way I think about it is not so much moving along the spectrum, is growing and developing as a child and a human being, where what was more challenging becomes less challenging, where you didn't speak. Now, maybe you could speak in very short utterances and then go on to become conversational in your speech. So I always look through the lens of development. And so that's what we're talking about. It may be the same pattern of strengths and challenges. You need similar and then more sophisticated supports, but it's about child and human development.
So really what you're saying is you outgrow some of those difficulties, which then makes some of those autism signs and symptoms, you know, less obvious, and perhaps even outgrow those things over time, so that they don't kind of lead to significant dysfunction when you're just trying to get around today's world. Would that be an accurate way of saying that?
Absolutely. And I would use a slightly different term. I wouldn't say outgrow, but for example, there's a lot of research into problem behaviors. Okay.
Right.
So a child who's very young and has limited speech let's say they don't want to go into the school cafeteria. Let's say we're pre-COVID days, right? And because they know it's noisy, they know it hurts their ears, it's overwhelming. That child may drop to the floor, okay? And that's his way to protest because he or she doesn't have any other way to let people know. As he develops some speech, he might be able to say, no, 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 I don't want to go, no. So my point is that you could say, well, you know, he doesn't protest, drop to the floor, tantrum, or whatever you want to call it, because he has other ways to express his fear of going in there.
Right.
So it's certain skills replace other ways of being. Right. And I think that's important to understand, because that's what we as parents and educators need to do. We have to help them acquire those skills.
Absolutely. I agree. You know, one of the most, I think, profound statements that I read in your book, Uniquely Human, and I want to just read it sort of verbatim and ask you to respond to it, is the following. You say, autism can be best understood as a disability of trust. Because of their neurological challenges, people with autism face tremendous obstacles of three kinds: trusting their body, trusting the world around them, and most challenging of all, trusting other people. So, I, as a pediatrician, I've never really heard autism defined or spoken of in that way, and I thought it was really meaningful. Can you explain a bit more about what you mean by that statement?
Sure. And I so much of what I put in that book, and just in general in my career, especially the last 10, 15 years where I've collaborated a lot with adults on the spectrum, so much comes from what I've learned from them.
Okay. Yeah.
So when we say we can't, a person on the spectrum can't trust the world, we know that the world is terribly unpredictable, routines change, appointments are canceled. So much goes on. Now, that bothers us very often, but we have better coping strategies. People on the spectrum literally just may become absolutely so either enraged, upset, because they require things to be more predictable. Mm-hmm. That we sing the same three songs to at the beginning of our class, you know, in first grade. It has to follow that sequence. I sit in the same seat in the cafeteria. Now, we all like predictability. And what I like to say is all of us benefit when we know how things are going to unfold, whether it's schedules or whatever. People on the spectrum crave predictability. So that's the world. That's the piece of the world, okay, as far as the issue trusting of not that. Trusting the world. In terms of trusting other people, think about this. People are terribly unpredictable as well. And autistic people and autistic children do better when a person, for example, always has a calm demeanor, talks to them in a similar way, when they are predictable. Autistic people don't do well with people who have sudden shifts of emotion. You know, they're very, very angry, and then they're very, very nice. They're trying to figure out, because their disability has to do with, you know, problems with the underpinnings, the neurological underpinnings of being social. And so people confuse them. People on the spectrum say all the time, you know, you people are so confusing to me, because you change all the time. So that's the issue of trusting people. Trusting your own body. I've had people on the spectrum say to me, you know, when I was a kid and I would get a cold, I wouldn't know whether I'm going to be sick forever or whether it was going to be just for a week. How about sensory issues? Why is it that all of you can deal with the music at a noisy concert, and for me, it's painful, for those kids who have the sensory sensitivities? So that's another issue. It's how do you trust your own body? Now, let me just add something quickly. There's a new area that's called interoception. And interoception has to do with being able to understand sensations in your body. And I know some people who are friends. We just interviewed a woman named Chloe Rothschild. Chloe says, I know I'm feeling pain, but I don't know where it's coming from. And it just makes me upset, and possibly I have a meltdown. But I can't say, oh, it's a pain in my back. So interoception is the ability to kind of localize and process sensations from your own body. So this is a new area that's being explored that a lot of autistic people are saying, yes, I never had a word for it. I have problems with that.
I see what you mean now. Trust really develops out of a sense of predictability and knowing what to expect from somebody else, from your body, from your environment. And I think that's where, you know, people with autism struggle the most, is that predictability is just not there, that maybe you and I might take for granted or have had more experience with. And so exactly. Helping them to manage that, I think, is what autism is all about.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
I love your view of repetitive behaviors that we've all seen in people with autism as coping mechanisms and ways of making sense of the world. One of these mechanisms that you talk about is echolalia or scripted language. Can you say more about how these behaviors actually do help?
Mm-hmm. So now we're going back into ancient history a little bit.
okay.
I did my doctoral dissertation on echolalia in the mid-1970s. And the reason I did it was the person who's now considered to be the grandfather of ABA, Ivar Lovaas, spoke a lot about language. Now, my training, I was, excuse the phrase, but again, a little jargon here. I was a psycholinguistics major undergraduate. So I studied language development and the relationship between language and how we think and how we move from our thoughts to our words. And I began working with autistic children, many of whom were echolalic, meaning they repeated speech. And as you said, sometimes it's immediate repetition. Want to go out. Sometimes it's delayed echolalia, which is also called scripting. Repeating right. things from movies, repeating something that mom said to dad the night before, repeating songs, etc. Okay, to get to your question, being a student of child and language development, I found some very obscure literature for typically developing children where these kids were called gestalt language learners. They used rote memory as a way of learning language. They would repeat what they've heard, they would memorize what they've heard. And so all of a sudden it was like, wait a second, but I was working with kids. And I found that kids were communicating or trying to communicate very often through their echolalia, through the repetition. So if you would say, wanna go out? They would say, wanna go out, play ball. They might add some words, change what they're saying. Lovaas and his colleagues at the time were advocating that you punish and try to get rid of echolalia because they saw it as an autistic behavior. They called it meaningless parroting. They called it psychotic speech. Let me just mention that these people did not know, and I'll say this boldly, these people knew nothing about language development. They were not experts in language development. They were experts in changing behaviors, okay?
Right.
So the bottom line was, we developed this whole theory. We published about 10 articles and chapters on how this is a different way of learning language. It may be drawn out over a much longer period of time. Some people kind of get stuck. Now, for typically developing kids, they go through these stages so rapidly that sometimes we don't notice it. But you know, some kids who don't have disabilities repeat speech a lot. But they may do that a lot between a year and a half, 2 to 3 years of age, and then they're on to much more creative language. So the point is, if you look from a developmental perspective, some of these speech and language behaviors are understandable as stages in development for autistic children. The tricky piece is, we may not, if a child says, and one of my favorite examples is a child I was consulting to, and a 12-year-old girl, and I walked into the classroom and she looked at me and she said, got a splinter. And her teacher said, don't worry, Barry's a nice man. Everything is okay. And she said, Barry's a nice man. She calmed down. She was saying, Barry, in this classroom, I don't know him. I'm feeling nervous and anxious. So sometimes, especially for scripting, we have to play detective.
Right.
So that's the bottom line. It's looking at the purpose and the function of behavior and not just saying, I don't understand that. That's strange. Let's get rid of it.
Yeah. No, okay. I think you make a lot out of just asking why. Why are we seeing this? Not like, how can we extinguish this?
Exactly.
Or how can we repress this? Because these are, like you said, they're coping mechanisms, they're defense mechanisms. They're there for a reason.
That's right.
And, you know, we often say, like, you know, to a child, their behavior at the time always makes 100% sense to them because it's what they have at their disposal. It's what they need at the time to help cope.
Yes.
And so I love how you put that. And, you know, many people that are not on the spectrum use these as well. I know, like, for example, when I'm biking up a hard hill, I sing a song in my head to myself all the time, over and over and over again, you know, keeping time with the pedal stroke.
That's right.
And so that's not very different from the echolalia and the scripted language that people on the spectrum might use.
That, absolutely. And you just made a very important point that using language in this way could serve many different purposes and functions. So when you say it to yourself to get in sync as you're on your bike, we would call that kind of a self-directive function. It's not to communicate to other people. It's to kind of get your movement in sync and give yourself kind of a little tool that allows you to
It's almost like a mantra, you know, kind of repeating something over and over again. It's soothing for people, and we use it in rituals and rites all the time as well, you know. So
absolutely,
it's not that far-fetched as a coping mechanism. Just, and then let's talk about restricted interest then. You call them enthusiasms.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's great, a great way to reframe that in a more positive light.
Yes.
How can enthusiasms be a coping mechanism or a way that people with autism get through their day?
Yes. And this is one of the things that I find so fascinating. So on our new podcast, we have what we call the enthusiasm of the week. And we ask parents or people listening to submit. So let me tell you about a couple of them from the last few weeks. One enthusiasm, it was a family from Louisiana, an African-American family. And I'm mentioning that because this young man who's, I think he's 12 years old now, his enthusiasm is Rocky movies and Creed movies. And so he watches the movies over and over again. He memorizes the whole scripts. And downstairs in the basement, they set up, I forget what the big bag's called, but a punching bag. And he actually now loves to dress up like Creed or Rocky. And he particularly likes Creed because he could relate to Creed
and he
gets up there and he punches the bag. But what his mom said is what was just an interest in the movies, now he uses it to cope when he's feeling upset or anxious. He'll say to his mom, I need to box, I need to box. And he goes downstairs, and as he's boxing, he repeats lines from Rocky or the Creed movies as he's doing that. And other people have taken an interest in him. And actually, I think they're going to pursue, you know, having martial arts or something else, which could enhance anybody's life if you get good at that. I could go on and on. Another young man, actually, he's not so young anymore. A young man who's 30 years of age. I know him since he was, seven or eight. He loves Disney films, and he loves to make drawings of Disney posters. So from the films. So he will ask you what your birthday is when you were born. He will make a poster for you of a Disney film that came out close to your age, with a poster, whether it's Bedknobs and Broomsticks or Mary Poppins or whatever it is, and they're beautiful. And he sells them on this. He just sold, there was a fundraiser for an autism charity, and his was the first to sell. They sold 10 of those posters at $100 each. And whereas other things, it's difficult for him to attend to. And he learned to read by reading the words on the Disney posters when he was much younger. So I can go on and on. But the thing about enthusiasms is it rivets attention. It adds to quality of life. Very often it's something that a person absolutely loves to do. I'm involved with a lot of adolescents and adults now on the spectrum through some theater programs. And some of these individuals are incredible artists, musicians, and it's not just a skill that appeared. It needed to be nurtured. The parents saw the interest and they nurtured those skills and abilities by bringing musicians into their life or art teachers. And so the enthusiasms could sometimes lead to employment, at least be hobbies, leisure time activities, and connect a person to other people who have the same interests. So there's all kinds of opportunities.
Even as a clinician, I think it's often a great way to establish rapport and to make a connection. You know, we do all of our visits now in COVID, you know, via telemedicine. Mm-hmm. And so yesterday I logged on and all of a sudden up on the screen pops Spider-Man. I mean, this boy was all into DC Comics or Marvel. I don't even know which one it is, but you know, he knew all the superheroes. And when I mentioned, you know, the wrong villain, he was right on top of it. And we spent a good 5 minutes.
There you go.
Just talking to, I was talking to Spider-Man on the screen. And then of course he came out of it and we talked about some other things as well, but it was a good way to kind of open up the conversation and find out how he's doing and really that he could trust me as well in engaging him in some of the things that he was interested in rather than just sort of dismissing that or pushing that aside and talking about the other quote-unquote important things, right?
So yeah, that's so true. And as you were giving the example, Rob, the word trust was just sitting on my tongue because if you trust people who are interested in what you are interested in.
Right.
You trust people who you feel you could have a meeting of the minds and you can enjoy shared positive emotion is the basis of trust. We trust people who we share good feelings with. And so that's what you were doing with that youngster. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And for that reason, actually, you know, children on the spectrum are some of my favorite patients to talk to. And I love sort of engaging them in their enthusiasms because I'm the kind of guy who kind of knows a little about a lot, so I can kind of, you know, talk about some things to a certain degree, but I love having them expand on it and build that trust relationship.
So, yeah, and in some cases, the next step is having them teach you.
Yes.
so what one young man, the latest enthusiasm, it's actually in the podcast that's out now, is birds. And,
oh, yeah.
And his mother sent me, we have this little form that people fill out on uniquelyhuman.com website, and the enthusiasm was literally like this: egrets, exclamation point, seagulls. And she went on. And he started telling me about different kinds of herons because I said, we have a great blue heron on a pond near us. And he said, oh, I love Goliath herons. And I said, I've never heard about a Goliath heron.
Right.
And he told me what colors it was. And that supports a youngster's self-esteem. If they know something that they can teach you or share with you.
So I imagine there are some parents listening who understand their child's emotional dysregulation. They understand why the repetitive behaviors are there, or the echolalia, and they're on board with everything you're teaching. And yet it still becomes frustrating, or maybe the repetitive behaviors are becoming a social obstacle or even potentially a source of harm. What would you say to those parents?
Yeah. What I would say and what I do say to parents, first of all, I want to acknowledge how they're feeling about that. So even though, you know, a big chunk of my career was focused on echolalia, I'll say to parents, it can drive you absolutely crazy sometimes to hear your child repeating that over and over. So
sure.
I want to understand their experience and I want to make it clear, just because we're trying to understand the purpose or the function, it doesn't mean that it's always helpful or okay. Even something that sounds as positive as enthusiasms, if a child is sitting in a classroom and is scripting the whole time about Rocky movies in the classroom, that's not going to be helpful in terms of learning. It might be distracting to the other kids. And so what we talk about is these are teaching opportunities. So we could teach a kid, and I think I actually use this phrase in my book, there's a time and a place. So here's what we're doing now. Here's our schedule. And then, hey, finish. If you finish your math, we could talk about Rocky for 5 minutes. That's okay. And it's things actually that all kids learn. But I think kids on the spectrum have problems inhibiting some of that. Mm. Now, when it comes to, another classic example is so-called self-stimulatory behaviors or self-stims. That That has been a 180-degree turnaround. It used to be thought of as autistic behaviors, you got to extinguish it. Actually, in the 60s and 70s, there was research that used shock on children to stop to stop them from flapping their hands or jumping up and down. And those treatment was, you identify autistic behaviors and you get rid of them. I mean, that's right. So the point is that now, the 180-degree turnaround is that most people understand that in most cases, when you rock, when you flap, when you tap your hands or you flick your fingers, that in many cases, those are self-regulatory. It's an attempt to calm yourself or distract yourself from what's upsetting in those situations. Mm-hmm. Is it always okay to do that? Not if it's disruptive, not if it's interfering. And what we do, and not just in our approach in the CERTS model, other people as well, it's called teaching replacements, okay? So can the child do something else that serves that same purpose? So rather than tapping a desk loudly, maybe he could squeeze a stress ball, or maybe even even rub his leg. So, and we all do that. I mean, we do things always to calm ourselves. So the point is what we say to parents is just saying stop the behavior doesn't work, because a lot of these behaviors serve neurological purposes for the child, communicative purposes if it's something like echolalia. So what we want to do with the parents is say, what else can we have him do? What support can we put into place so he or she doesn't have to do that? Now, one other quick point. In some cases, we need to change our behavior. So some forms of echolalia happen when a child doesn't understand what you're saying. So if we simplify or slow down our speech and a child understands it better, he may not come back to take his turn by repeating or echoing. So we play an important role here as to how we support, how we change what we do. Because if a child is very nervous around you, he might be there rocking back and forth and staring at his fingers. But if he's with a person that he's not nervous with, he might actually just be calm, have a calm body and look at you right in the eye.
Yeah. I can see why if it can be almost like a vicious circle, you know, where the behavior might be anxiety provoking in the parent, which then increases the anxiety in the child and the behavior increases. And then that, of course, feeds back to the parent and is kind of become a vicious circle from there. And it's so important that we, as parents or caregivers or teachers, make sure that we are not the source of the anxiety as well.
Absolutely.
So just to follow up on what you said, how do you involve the child in those replacement behaviors?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. It really depends upon the developmental level of the child. So let me start with a teenager who has a lot of language, understands much of what you say. You can actually bring it to what we call, excuse the term, but a metacognitive level of emotional regulation. What does that mean? What does that mean? We could talk with that youngster and say, you know, I noticed that sometimes when you get nervous, you begin to tap the desk or you scratch your arm. You know, I think, why don't we practice some other things? What else do you think you could do that could help? So for a student or a child at that level, you could talk about it and reflect on it. For another child who's much younger, sometimes we have to model replacements, okay? So if a child is tapping a desk loudly, maybe we want a little stress ball or something, a little fidget he could hold, and we could offer it to him and demonstrate how to use it. Some things will work, some things won't. So that's where we come from in terms of when I say I'm a developmentalist. What we do has to be a good fit for where the child is at, how much they understand, how much can we use language. We use visual supports a lot, and almost any good program for kids on the spectrum uses a lot of visuals now. So we could demonstrate through visuals. And we could actually have a visual of a child squeezing a ball. And
right,
so that the child could learn to do that.
That's so great. I think, you know, we've already alluded to the fact that there are some people in the lives of children and teenagers and adults with autism who seem to quote unquote get it. I mean, that's you talk about that in your book as well. Those who just seem to get it. How do you recognize someone who gets it, and how can we all become people who quote unquote get it?
Yes. And let me give credit where credit's due here.
Sure.
This comes under what we call the it factor. Okay.
Okay.
And I learned that when I gave a talk a number of years ago in Vancouver. There was a pediatrician in the audience, and we started talking about why is it that some people know how to connect with our kids and other people don't. Dr. Jill Calder, she's a pediatrician and has now an adult son, I believe, on the spectrum. He was a teenager at the time. She said, in my family, we call it the it factor. When I see my son with somebody who's trying to interact with him and he looks relaxed and it seems like he wants to stay with that person's got it, okay?
He knows
how to simplify the way he presents him or herself, simplifies language. And then she said, but there are people who are it-like, okay? It-like means that the person has good intentions. They want to work with my son, you know, they want to learn, but they're saying, I've never worked with a child on the spectrum before. Can you teach me? They're open, they want to learn, okay?
Yeah.
And then what I added to this continuum, the third point, and I said, then there are some it-less people.
Yes.
And the it-less people have a difficult time adjusting who they are when they're with an autistic child. They might be overly focused on strict discipline. They might not adjust the way they speak to the child. If the child's getting upset, they may not try to calm that child or do something that's helpful. And, you know, almost all parents have run into some it-less people. Thank goodness. I think the majority of people in education and health-related fields either are it-like or they got it. and the question that often comes up is, can you help or teach a person to get it or to be it-like? And I think it depends upon that person's personality. But I do a lot of that in my school consulting. I work with paraprofessionals and teachers. And in our educational model, we talk about here are the skills it takes, the interpersonal skills it takes to get it. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's also just so important to maybe get to know someone who's on the spectrum and talk about it and be open-minded. And then you realize that, you know, we often use the phrase in all sorts of different diagnoses, you know, see the ability, not the disability. And I think once you kind of take that different perspective, that lens, I think it helps you to get it.
Yeah. And thank you for saying that, because we're in an era where we are learning from autistic people.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so many adults now could say and could talk about, here are the people I trusted when I was young. Here are the people that I learned most from. Here is why I liked that teacher. And they could actually describe what were the qualities of that person that was helpful to them.
You've developed a model for helping children on the spectrum called the CERTS model. Can you just explain in a nutshell what that is?
Sure. And let me say, this was a team that developed this model. We are a multi-transdisciplinary team with training in psychology, occupational therapy, speech and language. And CERTS is an acronym. The acronym stands for what we refer to as three domains. The first domain, SC, is social communication. The second domain, ER, is emotional regulation. And the third domain, TS, is transactional support. And actually, we've touched upon all of those points in our discussion. Why do we focus on those domains? First of all, the research indicates that progress in social communication is one of the best predictors over time of kids and people on the spectrum doing much, much better. That's where the most of the research is. More and more, we now understand, and actually there's research in typically developing kids on emotional regulation, that the better regulated you are, the more you can make yourself available for learning and engaging or having other people help you, the more you are emotionally and physiologically well-regulated, the more you're going to experience success in school, have friendships, and so forth. So
right.
S-C-N-E-R has to do with what we feel are the foundations and underpinnings that helps kids be successful in everything from academics to, you know, some very basic caregiving activities, self-help activities. And transactional support is all of the ways we as professionals support children, adults on the spectrum, and support their families, and also support each other. So let me give an example. The two of you doing this podcast together is a form of transactional support, that that you are working together to make the podcast a better podcast than if you would do it individually. Okay. Mm-hmm. We also, under transactional support, we talk about how brothers and sisters and how peers and classmates in school may support a child on the spectrum. So another quick point. People say to us, well, do you have a toilet training curriculum in the CERTS model? Do you have a math curriculum in the CERTS model? And what we say is no, but if in every activity you focus on enhancing the skills in social communication and emotional regulation, then kids will be toilet trained more successfully, will learn right. the academics more successfully. These are the foundations of all of our learning. And luckily, the model, you know, has been embraced. Right now, it's probably more than a dozen and a half countries. It's expanded. So there's something universal about the model that people across all different cultures say, yes, we want our kids to be able to communicate, develop relationships through communicating, to be well-regulated emotionally and physiologically. And we have to provide the right supports to make that happen.
So does it replace or support, you know, things like IBI or intensive behavioral intervention? Or is it similar to that or different?
First of all, our model is not a one size fits all model. It's not though we have a curriculum, it's a very flexible curriculum. So it depends when people say, you're referring to IBI. Some people refer to IBI, ABA. Yeah. So when people say to me, quite honestly, compare CERTS to ABA, my response to that is, tell me what you mean by ABA. Because there are some forms of ABA that actually overlap and have some similarities with CERTS. There are some forms of ABA, especially primarily discrete trial intervention, that are very different than CERTS. We are much more of a natural activity model, and we teach the skills within the flow of natural activities. You might say, well, what form of ABA is more similar to CERTS? Pivotal response training, PRT, developed by Bob Cagle. It's been around for 20 years. Bob Cagle was a student of Lovaas's, but he's retired now, I believe, but he totally changed his ways. He went a totally different direction. So we're much more play-based. We want kids to initiate a lot. We want kids to make choices whenever possible. We use a lot of visual supports. There are significant differences, and we've published extensively on these differences. So, yeah.
Yeah. And ABA, of course, stands for Applied Behavioral Analysis, for those listeners who may not be aware of those acronyms.
That's accurate.
Now, your book and podcast, Uniquely Human, I mean, it's filled with stories. I love the fact that it's filled with stories because it puts real people behind some of the words that you write about.
Yes.
So it's real kids, families, and adults for whom autism is part of their life story. So can you leave us, maybe as we wrap up this podcast, with maybe one story that is top of mind today or after our discussion today that you could leave with us that has been particularly inspiring to you?
A story that I like to share, and I actually speak about it in my book, Uniquely Human, is a story of a young man named Justin. And I could actually say Justin Khanna. His parents are fine with talking about him, his real name. And I was one of the people who kind of confirmed his diagnosis at 3 years of age. Originally, the first diagnosis was severe, profound autism. His parents literally were told, don't expect much in Justin's life, okay? Justin began to speak more fluently. probably around 7, 8 years of age. Always showed an interest in cartoon characters. Long story short, his parents, with the help of people, nurtured his artistic abilities. Justin is now right around 30 years of age. Justin lives in his own apartment in New Jersey across the river from New York City. He teaches, pre-COVID, he'll probably get back to it. He teaches cartooning and art to typically developing kids as well as autistic kids. He works part-time in bakeries, designing children's birthday cakes with cartoon characters. His art, as far as some of his acrylics, his paintings, his charcoals, can sell for thousands of dollars. But wow. If Justin was here speaking with us, you would know within a few minutes that he's different and that he's on the spectrum. But he is a wonderful young man. People love Justin because he's so honest, so sincere. And the reason I'm giving Justin as an example is, you know, there are many, many people on the spectrum. And I have friends who, you know, college professors have written books, who give lectures around the world on autism. But Justin was one of those kids who really had to work hard, and his parents had to create those opportunities for him. And he just, you know, ran with it. He does computer animated graphics. And if you met him, he would say, "My name is Justin Khanna. I am an artist. Do you like cartoon characters?"
We know that you've been steeped in autism research, and we would just love to know what particular area of the research is giving you hope these days.
Yeah. We can even stretch it beyond the category of autism. I think everything that's happening in neurodiversity and I'm very involved in a number of initiatives there. And for your listeners who are not familiar with the term neurodiversity, it has to do with studying people who think differently, who communicate differently. It doesn't have to be an autism diagnosis, even though autism has really helped to launch the whole field of neurodiversity. And understanding that everybody has different brains, everybody's brain wiring is different. And so what gives me hope is, rather than seeing people who fall on the fringe of the so-called bell curve, you know, in terms of most of us who have similarities in the way we think, process language, but those who might be on some more of the extreme ends, who think differently, who have more peaks and valleys in what they're good at, that I think we're gaining a more respectful way and understanding in education that we don't have to teach all kids the same way, that we should teach to their peaks and valleys and provide the right supports for that. So that's what gives me hope. In the past, those differences were not respected. The term I use is they were pathologized. And now, now what's happening is those differences are seeing, and this is neurodiversity, part of the continuum of humanity rather than something that's less or deficient.
Yeah, I love it. And hopefully that just reduces stigma as well. And makes all of us more understanding of each other. In a way, we're all so neurodiverse. We're all different, like you said. We all have different brains.
Absolutely.
So thanks for that hopeful message. Well, thank you for speaking with us today. It's been such a great conversation. So many just words of wisdom, I think, that we'll all appreciate. Thank you for sharing those with us. Where can we go to find out more about autism specifically and your work? Where can we go for that?
Certainly. Yeah. My website, which is just my name, www.barryprezant.com, has a lot of my work, has a lot of articles that people could download for free that I've published over the years. The website for our podcast, which includes all of our archived episodes, is easy to remember, uniquelyhuman.com. And we have a lot of autistic people who are our guests, and we will have more. And so those are the two primary sources right now. And also our educational model certs, S-C-E-R-T-S, is www.certs.com. And you could learn all about the certs model. We have publications about the certs model there as well. So, yeah.
Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity. It was wonderful chatting with you.
Wow, I got so much out of that conversation. Rob, I would love to know, what's the number one takeaway you have for, say, parents in your practice?
Yeah, good question, Tony. I mean, I learned so much from this conversation with Dr. Prezant. I mean, he has such a unique way of looking at autism. I mean, in the past, we used to see many of these behaviors as just being things to suppress or in a much more negative way. And I think looking at these autism behaviors like echolalia and what he calls enthusiasms, I mean, I think that's just a much more positive way of viewing these behaviors as more coping mechanisms. This is how the child is dealing with the world around him. And I think once we see these behaviors in that more positive light, I think it's really beneficial for caregivers and teachers and parents and even the children themselves. So I love that perspective of autism, and I want to thank Dr. Prezant for bringing that to us today.
Yeah, I'm so grateful for all the wealth of experience he has and his generosity with it. If you have a child with autism, or if you know someone who has a child with autism, would you please share this episode? It's really our heartfelt desire that this advice would get into the hands of parents who need it. And we would love it if you would help spread the word. If you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, we would so appreciate it. It just helps to raise the profile and get these conversations to the people who need them.
Well, thanks for joining us today on the Smart Family Podcast. Also, remember to check out Dr. Prezant's podcast, Uniquely Human, for more on this topic. So thanks for joining us today. It was great having this conversation with you. And join us again next time. And it is our aim to help you love being home.